On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tensions in Nigeria's oil-rich region are on the rise, and the images are eye-catching. Local militiamen in masks, armed to the hilt, taking matters into their own hands. But what is really going on here? Journalist Sebastian Younger went deep into the mangroves and militia camps to find out. This hour, On Point, Sebastian Younger, the Niger Delta, and the fight over oil. Joining me now from New York City is Sebastian Younger, a best-selling author of The Perfect Storm and contributing Vanity Fair editor. He writes about blood oil in this month's issue. Sebastian Younger, so nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Jane.
Before we get into this harrowing trip of yours through the Niger Delta, set up the story for us and explain why this region is so critical to the United States and to the world.
Well, Nigeria is one of the biggest oil producers in the world, and it's very important for the United States in particular because the access is quite easy. It's just a boat ride across the Atlantic Ocean. There's no Middle Eastern politics to deal with. And in addition, the oil is very, very pure. It's light, sweet crude, which requires very little refining. In Nigeria, they say you can pump it right into your car and drive. I don't know if that's quite true, but it's very financially cost effective. So it's a very important source of oil for the United States. And it's also now in a very volatile country. And there's a lot of discussion about what would happen if militants succeeded in shutting down Nigerian oil production.
So when you went into the Niger Delta, you knew that no Western journalist had ever been allowed into one of these armed militant camps. How'd you get in?
Well, it was very complicated. I went in with a photographer who's based in West Africa, Mike Camber, who shoots for the New York Times usually. He went in with me for Vanity Fair magazine. He had taken some photographs of the militants, some of the only photographs taken when they showed up for a proof of life situation. They wanted to show that an American hostage was still alive. They met Mike and a couple of other journalists in the creeks. Some photos were taken, and that was it. Mike said you can email the head of the militant group. It's called MEND, the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta. His name is Jomo. You can email him and ask for permission to go in. Every journalist covering the story has done that, and Jomo has always said, no, we're not interested. When Mike and I got to the Niger Delta, I emailed Jomo. Jomo said no. And Jomo, by the way, it's not even sure that he lives in Nigeria. He really could be anywhere.
But this guy, he's sophisticated. He's articulate. You write in the article, very media savvy. He's got his own Yahoo account.
Yes, he's a very, very articulate, clearly very well educated man. A lot of these militant groups in West Africa, they don't really have a good perspective on their struggle. They don't have context for what they're doing. Jomo really, I think, has a sort of international context for this struggle. He's very articulate,
and he's the gatekeeper of the Delta.
Yes, for this one particular group, MEND, which I think is the least criminal and the most political of the groups. So he said no, like he's told every other journalist. And we went in anyway because we thought we had another contact who could guarantee our safety and put us in touch with MEND. As it turned out, this man did not make the phone call he had to make. We got into the creeks, went to the village where we were supposed to meet MEND, and indeed we did meet MEND, but they didn't know we were coming. They heard that some foreigners were in the creeks, that we might be spies, U.S. military intelligence possibly, and they descended on us, basically stripped to the waist, ready for battle with their guns cocked. Mm. And it was very, very terrifying.
We'll describe more about that. Describe the sort of ragtag team of young militants in speedboats, as I read in your article, with machine guns.
Well, we showed up in this village. And first we had to – the drums were beaten, and the community collected around us to hear our explanation for why we were there. The head man pulled up a chair, and we all sat down, and we sort of gave these sort of elegant speeches about why we were in the Niger Delta to document the oil pollution and the abuses of the oil industry, et cetera. And then some men with guns started to sort of drift in. And then some phone calls were made. There's a little bit of cell phone coverage in the creeks. And then another boatload of guys with guns showed up. And it just got tenser and tenser. And then Mend showed up. And these guys were absolutely different than the other guys. They were dressed in a sort of native fashion. And by that, I mean they were painted with white war paint. They had amulets, magical amulets tied to their bodies. They were stripped to the waist. Very, very strong guys. I mean, just physically powerful guys. And they showed up with very, very large, new, clean, expensive-looking machine guns. I tracked those machine guns down. They're made in Czech Republic. They're very expensive weapons, not the kind of thing you see in West Africa a lot. And they showed up. We were immediately accused of being spies. One of them walked up to me. I still remember he had white paint all over his face and this sort of ritual paint. And he walked up to me and poked me in the chest and said, "I'm going to kill you." And, you know, in countries like this, if you're accused of being a spy, it's a very, very dangerous situation. People do get killed over that accusation. And my blood really froze.
So these aren't guys in cast-off Western clothes and old AK-47s, as you say, these Mend militants. What do they want, Sebastian Younger?
Well, just to back up for a moment, the reason that they're painted up like this is they believe in their god of war is named Egbesu. And there's a cult of Egbesu. It's a sort of warrior cult. And they abide by that. And it involves fasting. It involves not having sex while you're fighting. It involves a sort of purity of lifestyle. And if you live that way, if you obey the precepts of Egbesu, you are bulletproof. And so these guys fight as if they are bulletproof. And so, of course, that sort of bravado is very intimidating to the other side, to the Nigerian military. And effectively, it seems like they're bulletproof because very often their enemies run away. But what they want is – what they say they want is control of their resources. It's a sort of phrase that obviously they've sort of memorized and can repeat to anyone who asks. But really what they want is for the social, the terrible conditions, the terrible poverty and social conditions in the Niger Delta to be addressed. It's an area of extreme poverty, and in the middle of it, oil is getting drilled out of the ground. Billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars of oil a year are getting pumped out of the ground. There is, of course, the attendant oil pollution in the creeks that have destroyed the local fishing industry. When you go into the creeks, you see people in dugout canoes fishing. Well, the fish stocks have just been decimated, so they no longer can really earn a living. And, of course, there's a lot of very poor areas in Africa. What's disturbing about this scene is that this poverty exists alongside the mechanisms of wealth, the oil wells and the oil pipelines. That is what is so disturbing to Mend and, frankly, to journalists who go in there.
Describe more about the conditions along the Niger Delta. No schools, no clean drinking water. It's pretty bad.
It's really appalling. There's no clean drinking water. People drink water out of the creeks. There's no sewage system, so the creeks are sort of used for everything. When you're in the creeks, these elaborate mangrove swamps in the Niger Delta, you can see the sheen of oil on the surface of the water, and people are drinking this water. And, of course, children are getting sick and dying. There are no schools. There's no electricity. There's a lot of malaria. It's really just about a Stone Age existence in there. And, again, that describes a lot – tragically, it describes a lot of Africa, many villages in Africa. But these villages are right next to oil wells, and that it's that juxtaposition which I think is really sort of inflaming the situation there.
So do they blame the oil companies for their situations, or do they blame the Nigerian government?
Well, interestingly, they really blame the oil companies, and it's complicated because it really is the Nigerian government that should be providing clean drinking water, electricity, et cetera, et cetera. The oil companies, I mean, any journalist doing a story like this has to fight the urge to think of the big oil companies as the bad guys. I mean, that's sort of the natural conclusion you might start out with. And it's much more complicated than that. To be fair to the oil companies, They have contracts with the Nigerian government. They're very, very specific. They have to pay a defined amount of their profits to the Nigerian government, and it's an enormous amount. It's 60, 70, 80. I've heard as high as 90% of their profits go straight back to the Nigerian government. But the Nigerian government is so incredibly corrupt that very little of that money makes it back into the creeks. The people in the Delta they don't focus on the sort of intangible corruption of the government. I mean, that corruption is sort of this concept, and it's very hard to pin down. But the oil wells, the pipelines, are right there in their backyard. The oil companies are right there in front of them. So that's what they focus on, and that is what has sparked this increasingly violent militancy in the Delta.
Sebastian, I wanted you to describe more about these team of militants. You described them as becoming very powerful, and they've got a lot of people's attention. How are they running their operation there in the Niger Delta?
Well, there are a lot of militant groups in the creeks, and they really do run the gamut from completely criminal to fairly principled. The most principled would be, I think, being MEND. It's very easy to steal oil in the creeks of the Niger Delta. There are some 6,000 kilometers of pipeline owned by Shell alone, and Shell is just one of the major oil companies. And if you know what you're doing, you can – it's very dangerous, but you can drill a hole in one of the pipelines and just drain oil out of it into a barge and take the barge offshore and sell it to a oil transport ship off the coast of Nigeria. Of course, the Nigerian Navy is there to make sure you don't do this, but they're paid $60 a month, and it's very, very easy, given the amount of money you're making off of stealing oil. It's very easy to buy off the Nigerian Navy and, in fact, enlist their support to protect these barges of oil, stolen oil. Stealing oil is called bunkering, and so the bunkering business in the Niger Delta funds a lot of these militant groups.
Several billions of dollars worth a year, isn't that right?
That's right. The something like 10 to 15% of all oil exported from Nigeria was actually stolen and resold into the international market by militant groups. Not exclusively militant groups, but it was stolen. It's stolen. It's bunkered oil, something like 10 to 15%. And this is in an oil economy where the Nigerian government is taking $1 billion a week in payments from international oil companies. So it's an enormous amount of money.
So is this money what's enabled these groups to organize themselves so well and become such a major threat?
Yes, it allows them to buy weapons. It allows them to buy off the Nigerian Navy. It allows them to buy off Nigerian politicians. They have also been kidnapping Western oil workers off of oil rigs. In one case, they went something like 50 miles offshore in open boats, converged on an oil rig, scampered up the scaffolding, and took everyone off the rig and back into the swamps, and later basically sold them back to the oil companies for an enormous ransom. So they do have ways of making a lot of money. And I should add that the governors in some of the Delta states and local politicians, they're making money at this too, because what they will do is arrange for the ransom money to be paid to the militants, but they will take a cut of it. So the politicians aren't even opposed to ransom to kidnapping. There's an economy of corruption in the Delta which flows in both directions, to and from the militants, to and from the oil companies and the politicians. It's very, very hard to pull apart. Mm.
Sebastian Younger, before I bring another voice into our conversation, I want to say that we'd hope to have someone representing an oil company in the Niger Delta join us for this hour. We requested someone from Shell, ExxonMobil, and Chevron. They all declined. ExxonMobil provided a comment and this statement: ExxonMobil and its affiliates, including Mobil Producing Nigeria, MPN, place a high priority on the safety and security of our personnel and our facilities. MPN has programs and measures in place to provide security and safeguards to protect our people and operations. We do not discuss the specifics of our security arrangements. Having said that, I'd like to join now, bring in Abuja, from Abuja, Nigeria, Namdi Obasi. He's a senior analyst with the International Crisis Group's West Africa Project. He's a native of Nigeria and has been closely following the activities in the Niger Delta. Mr. Obasi, it's nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
Can you put into perspective for us what Sebastian Younger has been talking about, the rise of these militias in the Niger Delta, specifically the Mend militia? How long have they been at this?
Yeah, I really can't add much to what Sebastian has said. He's captured the situation very graphically and very correctly. There's been some dynamic in the evolution of the militant groups. Initially, they were concerned really with environmental pollution, and to that extent, they were focused on the oil companies. But over time, there's been a realization that the oil companies is just part of the problem. The wider problem has to do with the Nigerian government, and not only with the central government in Abuja, but with the local and state governments in the Niger Delta. So there's also a protest against governance, misgovernance, actually, in the Niger Delta. I think that progression from communal agitation against oil pollution, environmental pollution, to more of a protest against the Nigerian government and against the local government, that's more like what we're dealing with now.
Is it correct to say, Mr. Obasi, that the militants have tried to get their message across before peacefully and then have realized in recent months that other tactics might work better, taking hostages, staging spectacular attacks? That's a better way, a more high-profile way of getting media coverage.
Yeah, you're correct. Initially, the protests were by communal groups, the towns and the villages in the Niger Delta, and then by civil society organizations. But then they didn't seem to get much response from the government and from the oil companies. So the militancy is actually a progression from that earlier level of protest to a more muscular, a more vibrant level of protest. Mm. And the groups are becoming more organized. They seem to have a better understanding of the use of the media. And they seem to understand that if you take hostages, then you get attention of CNN and BBC and the Western media, and that gets your point across to the international community a lot better. So to that extent, they're using more of the media now than they used to do before.
Sebastian Younger, Mr. Nambi Obasi talks about this progression. What are the tactics of the militants of late?
Well, as you asked, in the 90s, there were very peaceful demonstrations, particularly in Ogoniland, against the drilling of oil and the exploitation of that resources. And they ended very violently, very, very violently, brutally put down by the Nigerian government. So now what happens, there are community protests, but there is also this militancy. And basically, they are young guys in their teens, in their 20s. As I said, they're very well armed. Really armed with I think some of the best weaponry that money can buy. These belt-fed machine guns that I saw them use are capable of shooting down aircraft. They have an anti-aircraft capability, which is really alarming. And they live in these armed camps deep in the mangrove swamps. The Nigerian Navy either doesn't know where they are or doesn't dare go in after these guys. And they zip around in these very high-powered speedboats, and they can go 50 miles offshore, probably further. But they also the boats are small enough to hide in the mangrove swamps in places where the Nigerian Navy could never reach them. And essentially what they do is they come darting out of these little creeks. They'll take over oil barges. They'll take over oil supply ships that supply the offshore oil rigs. They'll blow up oil pipelines, and they'll take hostages. Particularly Western hostages seem to get the attention of the international media. In the past year, something like 100, they've taken something like 100 hostages. They've never killed any hostages, although one or two have died in attacks by the Nigerian Navy trying to secure their release.
And what sort of those kinds of tactics, their efforts, Sebastian Younger, would be enough to really hurt the United States as far as oil production and, as you say in the article, bring about some sort of U.S. recession or global impact?
Well, they've already shut down about a quarter of Nigerian oil production, from 2.5 million barrels a day to 2 million barrels a day. And they threaten to completely eliminate Nigerian oil production. And to understand what would happen then, we have to go to something that I discovered in my research. It was called the Oil Shockwave Panel. It included some very, very high-level government officials, including current Secretary of Defense Robert Gates. And this was several years ago. And they were given – the Oil Shockwave Panel was – it was convened in Washington. And they were given several scenarios, one of them being a complete shutdown of Nigerian oil production. And what they came up with was that that would – Nigerian oil is so important to the American economy that that would trigger probably something like $80 a barrel oil on the world market, which it was pointed out is something that the U.S. economy could recover from. The interesting thing about oil is that as it gets more expensive, people use less of it and then the price comes down. So we would recover from that, but the effects sort of ripple through the economy and cause temporary damage. The very dangerous thing about a shutdown of Nigerian oil production is that we sort of count on Nigerian oil. It's so accessible to the U.S. and it requires so little refining. We count on that as a buffer between us and chaos in the Middle East. And if we lost Nigerian oil production, it would mean that there was nothing protecting us from, say, a terrorist attack on oil infrastructure in the Middle East. And I think the fear is that Al-Qaeda and other groups in the Middle East are savvy enough so that if they saw Nigerian oil production shut down, they might think this is a great time to attack oil infrastructure in Saudi Arabia, and that a succession of events like that, this oil shockwave panel found, could produce oil prices of over $120 a barrel. That would be, I think, about $6 for gasoline at the pump, and it would be enough. The analysis stated it would be enough to trigger a major recession in this country.
In your Vanity Fair piece, you say, quote, oil reserves in politically stable countries have more value per barrel than oil in politically unstable countries. As we speak, the value of Nigerian oil as a function of the capital investment that must be risked to produce it is in steady decline. And that is the militants' trump card. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's similar to the fact that if the world's not going to just run out of oil. What's going to happen is that oil will be someday too expensive to extract from the ground, but there'll still be reserves down there. So when you drill oil out of the ground offshore in deep ocean, it's about twice as expensive to get at that oil, which makes it less attractive to investors and to oil companies. That's effectively what's happening to oil in the Niger Delta. Most of the oil is drilled out of the creeks. It's very shallow water. It's quite easy to get at, except that you have to build in a certain amount of money for sabotage of oil rigs, ransom payments for oil workers, and even a possibly catastrophic attack on, say, an LNG plant. The Bonny Island LNG plant is seen to be particularly vulnerable, a plant that costs billions of dollars to build. So when you risk that kind of capital investment, effectively the value of the oil that you're pumping declines. Mm-hmm. And if it declines too far, oil companies will consider simply moving to other less complicated countries to work in. One oil supply company, Wilbros, has already pulled out of Nigeria. It's just too expensive for them to operate there.
Sebastian Younger is our guest, contributing editor to Vanity Fair magazine. He is the author of the article Blood Oil in the February edition of Vanity Fair. I'd like to go to the phones. Natick, Massachusetts. Sam is calling. Sam, you're on the air.
Thank you. Good morning, Jane, and good morning, Sebastian.
Hello.
Good morning.
Once again, it's only NPR that exposes and brings public interest and debate into public policy that affects every single one of us in this nation. And one more reason why we should all contribute. We pay a lot for cable television, et cetera, et cetera. Any contribution to NPR is worth it. Anyway, going back to the topic. I will start by saying violence of any kind, it leads nowhere. you know, as a physician, we, you know, most of us tend to, you know, focus on, you know, on treatment rather than prevention.
Do you have a question for Sebastian Younger, Sam?
Yeah, the question I have for Sebastian is this. Sebastian, have you ever thought of the cause of this violence, which may, A, number one, that the money, which you said in your, you know, all in all your, you know, conversations now, A, the money that is being sold for this oil, no matter which country, from west to east, none of that money gets returned back to where it belongs.
Right. So where is the money going? I guess that's the question, Sebastian.
Well, most of the money from the oil drilled out of the Niger Delta is going to the Nigerian government. And again, the problem is it's a very, very corrupt government. It's been estimated that something like $400 billion worth of oil revenue has been stolen or misspent by Nigerian government officials over the past several decades. That's almost as much as all of the Western aid to all of Africa in that time. It's a staggering amount of money.
So with all this oil money coming in, Sebastian Younger, the state, does it really need taxes from people, right? So is there really any incentive for the government to build schools or hospitals or to help their own people?
Well, this is – it's part of something – a phenomenon known as the curse of resources in Africa. It's been noted by economists that countries – African countries and other parts of the world that have very valuable resources like oil or diamonds are prone to tremendous corruption and civil war and ultimately end up being poorer than other countries that don't have these resources. Nigeria is one of the poorest countries in the world. So one of the ways that works is that the government is so flush with easy cash that there's no tax, there's no enforced taxation system. So the citizens of the country do not they're not as critical of their government because they're not spending their own, they're not paying their own money in taxes to the government. If they were, they might hold their government more accountable. The money seems to be sort of free money flowing in from the outside. So there isn't this pressure of accountability that you might get in a country that is based on taxation system and there are citizens groups and they yell, they get angry at their government for not plowing the snow out of the streets or whatever it is.
Mr. Abbasi, I'd like to go back to you for just a moment. How do you see this situation resolving itself in the Niger Delta? Will these communities starved for the basic needs of life, will they ever get what they deserve, what they need?
Yes, I think they will, but it's a tall order, actually. It has to do with the structure of Nigerian federalism system. I think after the elections in April, we'll get back to constitutional amendments, and that should give more oil revenue to the Niger Delta than they have been getting in the past. But that is only one part of the problem. Actually, between 1999 and 2007, the Niger Delta has earned more money than in the past. I mean, constitutional amendments in the 1999 constitution provided for 13% derivation, what we call derivation. That's 13% of revenue goes back to the area from which it came. And to that extent, the Niger Delta has actually attracted more revenue than in the past. But just like Sebastian said, it's really a problem of corruption. And it's not just at the federal level, but the money that has gone to the local level, to the state government, to the local government, hasn't made any impact on the livelihood of the people. The human welfare hasn't improved, human security hasn't improved, and that is what we'll have to face after the elections in April. Eventually, the communities will benefit, but the struggle will have to be sustained. Improvements have to be made. Accountability has to be improved, and that will take quite some time. We've had a situation where you have the state legislature that were supposed to hold the executive, the state executives accountable, but they just haven't done that. And maybe we'll have to look for ways of making the state parliaments more alive to their responsibilities of making the government accountable.
Nnamdi Obasi, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for being with us, sir, from Abuja, Nigeria. Thank you. Sebastian Younger, I want to go back to you because I think it's worth noting that the United States just assigned a new command in Africa. Will it take significant acts of violence to resolve this? Are we closer to some sort of action militarily or otherwise than we might think?
That's a tough question. Recently, the government of Nigeria requested that the United States send a contingent of Marines, U.S. Marines, into the Niger Delta to help, quote, keep the peace, really help protect the oil infrastructure. And that was declined. So on one level, the Bush administration is reluctant to send American troops into Nigeria. Understandably so, I think. But there is, I don't know how concrete these plans are, but there is the possibility of, I think it's called AFRICOM. It would be a U.S. military center on islands off the west coast of Africa in the Gulf of Guinea, right next to the Nigerian oil fields. I think it's no coincidence that AFRICOM might be stationed right in the middle of the most oil-producing area of Africa. Frankly, if all-out civil war broke out in the Niger Delta and the oil infrastructure was really truly at risk and we had troops nearby, it's hard to imagine that we wouldn't do something. Oil is tremendously important to this country. Just about everyone I know drives a car, Republican or Democrat, they're all driving cars, and we need oil. And I think it's not inconceivable we could become involved there.
Sebastian Younger, you had another meeting with the MEND militants that you talk about in your article. I'd like you to tell us about it and tell us what they told you, the militants, about their plans for the future.
Yes, I mean, every meeting I had with them, they sort of got scarier and scarier. Well, there was only two. The first one was frightening enough, but we were eventually released. Jomo was alerted that there were strangers in the creeks, and as I said, there was a little bit of cell phone reception, and these are Ijaw tribesmen, and Ijaw in South Africa and in America were Googling our names to see if we really were journalists. And when word came back that we were journalists, and Jomo called and had us released, had these guys release us.
Jomo being the gatekeeper of this militant group.
That's right. Jomo is the spokesman and leader, I guess, of MEND.
Who, by the way, is likely in South Africa, I think, is your report.
Possibly. It's thought he might be in South Africa. It's very important to note that these guys did release us. They were not drunk. They were not smoking marijuana. There was a chain of command. Basically, from one word on a cell phone, these guys obeyed and released us. That's important. In West Africa, that's not always the case. The chain of command is very shaky. The fighters start drinking, and they're not really in control of their commanders. These guys were absolutely disciplined. And when they got the word to release us, they released us, no hard feelings. And we were eventually invited back by Jomo. I continued an email correspondence with him. I convinced him of the good that might come of journalists actually going into the creeks to see a village that was destroyed by the Nigerian military, that was bombed by the Nigerian Air Force, and to meet the militants themselves. And in fact, that happened 2 weeks later. On our last day in Nigeria, we took a boat into the creeks. We were picked up by MEND, brought into their armed camp deep in the mangrove swamps, and we were able to spend a couple of hours with these guys, about 100 guys, all painted up in a very frightening, intimidating way. But they were very friendly. At one point, one of them had said, "Don't be worried. You have nothing to fear from us. You're safe with us." I mean, I think they knew we were quite nervous.
And yet they told you that the Delta was bracing for a new round of attacks, as you write, quote, "The first phase was just a test run. Soon the real violence will come and we will let loose." Hollow threats, Sebastian Younger, or did you believe them?
I believe them. The man who said that was Brutus. He had on a face. They all had on face masks, and I interviewed Brutus for quite a while. And he said that there would be a wave of attacks. He said it would happen in November, last November. There would be a wave of attacks that would completely destroy oil infrastructure in Nigeria. And November came and went, and that never happened. Even the U.S. Embassy in Abuja was warning of attacks in the Niger, devastating attacks in the Niger Delta. It never happened. There was, I think, a power struggle within MEND. They seem to have split. And sometimes you get contradictory statements coming from Jomo and from other MEND leaders. There was some kind of power struggle, I think. What I heard is that in the next 14 days, something called Operation Black Locust will be initiated. But you never know. I mean, it's a very volatile, fluid situation. I think MEND and the other militant groups don't quite dare commit the kind of acts that they're capable of, that they're militarily capable of, a massive attack on oil infrastructure, because I think, frankly, they're worried about basically all-out war with the Nigerian military, and they should be worried about that. For their part, the Nigerian military, I think, doesn't quite dare sweep the Delta and try to round these guys up because it might trigger a catastrophic attack on oil infrastructure. So the, so these guys are sort of bluffing each other a little bit.
Tiptoeing around each other. I want to take a call from Boston. Chris is on the line. Boston, Chris, you're on the line with Sebastian Younger.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Mr. Younger.
Hello.
Hi.
On March 24th, I will be demonstrating on Boston Common against the level of violence in Iraq, which is ostensibly to support oil security for U.S. corporations. And when we contrast that with the violence that's going on in Nigeria, you see that there is a disproportion. And so I don't necessarily sympathize with any actors in this, but I am wondering, to what extent do these militants have a real community base, and to what extent did you investigate them providing social services for those communities?
Good question, Chris. Thank you. Sebastian?
Well, they're not really in a position to provide social services. I mean, these are guys sleeping in tents under mosquito netting in the mangrove swamps. All they really have is their weapons and satellite television with a little generator to run the TV. I mean, they're not in a position to drill water wells, that sort of thing. That really is the government's job. They do have tremendous support. I mean, none of these camps really would be able to function without the cooperation and the tacit blessing of the local communities. The communities bring them food. They support them in all kinds of ways. They warn them when the Nigerian military is coming. These guys really could not exist without the blessings of the local communities. I think the local communities realize that they're sort of shouting into the wind when they try to reach the oil companies and the Nigerian government. And what does get the attention of oil companies and the Nigerian government is attacks on oil infrastructure.
Right.
That sort of does work, and it is working, frankly.
Let me ask you this. From your reporting, Sebastian Younger, how much responsibility do the U.S. oil companies bear in this, in taking care of these local villagers and the villages along the Niger Delta?
Well, that also is sort of infinitely complex. They are... I mean, on one level, it's the Nigerian government's job to take care of their own people. It's the oil companies have contracts with the Nigerian government. They provide the Nigerian government with enormous amounts of money, something like $1 billion a week. They're discharging their contracts to the letter. On one level, it's hard to fault them. On another level, the reality of the situation is they're giving all that money to a government that they know is completely corrupt. So the question is, do you go beyond the terms of your contract and do a little bit more to ease the situation for everybody? It won't work if just one oil company does that. I think what needs to happen, I think there needs to be a consortium of all the Western oil companies. They come to an agreement that they will take, 5% of the money they give to the Nigerian government, and they will funnel it directly into the Delta and not even as cash, because as soon as you give cash to a village headman, that cash disappears.
Right.
You have to drill the wells, the water wells yourself. You have to provide electricity yourself. Something like that has to happen. If the Western oil companies just pull out, what will happen is that might sound like a principled act, but the Chinese are already trying to negotiate oil contracts with Nigeria. The Iranians have succeeded in that. What you just have is other actors moving into the situation that will probably behave even worse than Western oil companies. So that's not really a solution either.
Are there better protection mechanisms for the oil companies? What about moving the industry offshore, say?
Well, you can move the industry offshore, but the further offshore you go, the more expensive it is to drill out of the ground. And then you start to have that same decline in profitability. At a certain point, it's not just not profitable enough, and they don't drill the oil. I'm not sure. I think ultimately the solution has to be a political and social one. I don't think it's out of reach, but everyone is sort of defending their own positions. I think the oil companies really need to act collectively and in some ways dictate terms to the Nigerian government and come what may.
I want you to tell the story that you wrote about in Vanity Fair. You describe sitting in this sprawling Shell Oil Company compound in Warri, Nigeria, and seeing what was just over the fence on the other side. Can you tell that story? Describe that.
Yes, I was speaking with the helicopter pilot who had been kidnapped by militants a few years earlier, and he'd spent a couple of miserable weeks in the mangrove swamps and was worried about getting malaria and thought he was going to be killed. And even after that experience, he said, you know, these guys, frankly, they have a legitimate gripe. I mean, he really had sympathy for them. And he said, look, he pointed around, and there was big floodlights illuminating a tennis court, and there's a swimming pool and an outdoor bar and all that stuff, all this stuff that was to make in order to make the Western oil workers sort of feel comfortable and at home in Nigeria. Of course, the entire thing was surrounded by a chain link fence and heavily guarded. And just on the other side of the fence was the neighboring Nigerian village, which had been plunged into darkness because there are no government services in Nigeria. There's no electricity. There's nothing. And so the village was completely dark. And he pointed to it and he said, you know, that village has been there for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. Why don't we just run a line from our generator just through the fence to that village? Why don't we do that? And the answer, which he heard from a Shell official, I'm not sure it was Shell, one of the oil company officials, the answer was, well, if we do that for this village, they will all want electricity and we're not prepared to provide that. So they don't do it for anyone. And as a result, there is almost no goodwill in the Niger Delta.
I'm just curious what struck you personally, Sebastian Younger, as you made this harrowing trip into the Niger Delta. What was it that struck you in sort of a base human, very personal level?
I guess one of the most tragic things about it was that these guys that I spoke with, the militants, a number of them had finished high school and had aspirations of going to college. Some of these guys were really very educated guys, and their lives were going nowhere. These are young men full of enthusiasm and learning and who love their country, and they're sleeping under mosquito netting in a mangrove swamp with a machine gun because the conditions of the communities that they are from are so intolerable. So many people are dying of disease, and there's an entire wasted generation in Nigeria of young men like that. And why should a 17-year-old guy have to take up arms in a country that's not even at war? That, to me, was one of the real startling tragedies. And another, frankly, having covered a lot of West African wars, was that these guys were so well-disciplined that there was a chain of command, that they are absolutely determined and serious. And I don't think they can be brushed off as just a bunch of rabble rousers with guns. They are serious guys, and they will die for this cause, I do believe.
Sebastian Younger joining us from New York City. He is the author of the article Blood Oil in the February edition of Vanity Fair magazine. You can read a clip of that from onpointradio.org. Sebastian Younger, thank you very much for your time. Fascinating hour. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.